Yeah, you know, Joe was definitely one of the. Oh, one second. Oh, I ran. This will get cut out. I ran a long way this morning and I'm having a cramp.
We might keep that in, Paul.
Oh, the hell you will.
I was going to say, Darby, I want that in.
Oh, man. This is Paul Johnson with The Optimistic American. Now, my guest today is a fun one for me, Boyd Matheson. Now, Boyd wouldn't remember this, but many years ago, when I was working, helping out local government, I used to be the mayor of Phoenix, I actually knocked on his door when he was the chief of staff for a senator in Utah named Mike Lee. I talked to him about a particular bill, and what was interesting was just to understand how well he understood our Congress, the Senate, the House, how our government actually worked. He was a wealth of knowledge. What I also can tell you about Mike is that he has been deeply involved in a variety of different programs. He led the Sutherland Institute. He's a highly sought-after political consultant and strategist, and he also is the owner of Trillium Strategies. Today, he is a host of a radio program called Inside Sources at KSL News Radio in Utah. This is a fun conversation. We talk about a lot of different things. We talk about some politicians. Certainly, Ronald Reagan comes up, Marjorie Taylor Greene, and AOC. We also speak about how our government works, how leadership works, how you actually play a role in leadership, the importance of agency and accountability. The importance of finding meaning and purpose. And Boyd actually talks about a great program going on in Utah where they've engaged prisoners in entrepreneurship and the difference that it's making in their life. The point is that we're looking for ways to try to bridge those divides between the two different factions that exist in America. And that's what this discussion's about. Now, if you like what it is that we do, just go ahead and push that subscribe button and let's get started with Boyd Matheson. Well, Boyd, I'd like to welcome you to the Optimistic American Show today. And you know that you have an amazing experiences that you've had in your life. You've worked in the United States Senate. You worked for Senator Mike Lee. You're also one of the most sought-after consultants in the country. You know the inside of this system very well. You've also been in business. Here's the question that I want to start with. I want to start with, what do you think is the biggest problem that we're having in our country? But I want you to back that up by also telling me what you're the most proud of in the United States.
Yeah, so I think one of the biggest challenges in the country right now and what's broken is our politics. And I think it's very safe to say that our politics has failed. So I can be a little pessimistic about the politics right now, but I'll tell you, Paul, and I've never been more optimistic and more bullish about the future of the country. And let me tell you why. The whole reason why I'm optimistic is because in America, the politicians have never led this country. It's community and culture that lead, and the politicians follow. And you can go all the way back to the beginning of the Republic, and it was community. It was grabbing 70 guys out of the church, and that became Lexington and Concord. It was community driven. Or you can go even to something like Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier in Major League Baseball in 1947. 1947. It took Congress 17 more years to get around to doing any kind of meaningful civil rights legislation. You can even look at the easy stuff. Do you know that Congress voted against having a Mother's Day multiple times? Now, I'm a guy who has seven sisters, a mother, a wife, three daughters, and three granddaughters. And if mother is in the title, the vote is yes. But Congress voted against it. And it was this sweet woman from West Virginia who simply wanted to honor her angel mother. And she gave up on Congress. She went back to community and she started in West Virginia. West Virginia was the first state in the nation to have a Mother's Day. And then she went to Connecticut and to Rhode Island and to Massachusetts. And only after every state in the nation had passed a Mother's Day, then and only then did Congress boldly, courageously step forward and declare we shall have a Mother's Day. And so it's community and culture that lead, the politicians follow. I remember coming out of the 2016 election cycle, and there was so much division and so much hate and so much anger and so much negativity. And I remember the Saturday morning after the election in 2016, and there were people across the political spectrum who were frustrated and exhausted and exasperated. And we have something in my neighborhood that I think is the epitome of why I'm proud and why I'm optimistic for the future. So every year I have a neighbor who's amazing. And we have in our neighborhood every year a 1K donut run. So 1K is barely the length of a street in our neighborhood. But everybody shows up. And I remember that morning I did not want to go because I was tired. I was exhausted from the 2016 campaign. And my wife said, nope, we go. And so we went. And I'm telling you, I walked onto a scene that was extraordinary. It was absolutely extraordinary. As community came together, each year they pick a different charity that they're going to donate some money to. There were a group of students from the local university who had seen it on social media, and they all showed up. We had someone give a speech about, you know, how hard this was going to be. This, you know, we trained so hard for this 1K run. But as I walked around, nobody was talking about the election. Nobody was talking about who won, who lost. In fact, the only thing I heard, the only mention I heard was one of my neighbors who said, you know, we did something in my house this week that we have always done. And that is we pray for the president of the United States. And we continue to do that today. And the race started, the race was over before it started. But then the community stood there together for hours talking about things that mattered, things that they were concerned with, things that they were going to make a difference on. And so to me, that's the essence of it all, is that it's community and culture that lead, and the politics will follow. And so you can listen to all the headlines and all the drama and debate going on in our nation's capital, but just go walk around your neighborhood tonight. Just look at your neighbor, because that's where it's going to change. It's neighbor helping neighbor in need. It's someone taking a meal into a sick friend. It's a fifth grader standing up to a bully for another kid in the class. It's a teacher staying after class to help a struggling student. It's a rabbi, a priest, or a local faith leader helping a wounded soul. That's the essence of this country, always has been, always will be. And we just need to remember, as long as we have that, the politics will take care of itself in the end.
Yeah, you need the title of the Optimistic American behind you. Maybe I need to lose it every now and then. I do think that it's important to pray for your president, but sometimes I have to pray harder than others, I find. So I'm going to come back to the problems, but I want to stick on this for a moment because I really like this concept. To me, what you talk about watching how the mess that's happening, what's going wrong in our political system. What I'm amazed by is on any given day, if I turn on CNN, MSNBC, or Fox, I leave stressed. I just leave stressed. But then I go back and I talk to my friends, of which are Republicans, Democrats. I have Trump supporters, Biden supporters. I have 9 brothers and sisters. They're all over the place. That it doesn't look anything like what I think I'm watching on television, which seems like we're almost in a civil war. But that's not how I view the people that I care about and love and talk to on a daily basis. They're on to other issues. Here's kind of my thought, and I'd love your comments and thoughts on this. I think it was intentional from the beginning. The idea, you know, our government's done a lot of amazing, wonderful things. You can't take that away from them. They built roads and dams and bridges and even took us to the moon. But the single most important thing our government did from the very beginning was that it empowered the individual over itself. Now, I've heard arguments saying, no, the government never had the right to do that in the first place. Well, exactly. That's what our country believed. We believe that every person was worthy of dignity, that every individual was worthy of rights, that God saw all of us equal, so government had to do the same. And there was this concept that was built into it. That concept meant that we had a flourishing private sector, a flourishing a set of individual innovations. Not everything was being driven by government. There was a separation with it. Now, at the same time, they adopted the policies of Adam Smith because they didn't like the mercantilist theories that existed. But nonetheless, point that I guess I'm getting to here is, I think this idea that you're talking about, that there's such a huge separation between what's going on in private life versus government, was intentional from the beginning.
Yeah, no question about that. And I think you've struck an important chord in looking at all of this. Government does have a role to play, to be sure. And it's staying in the lane, I think, is the most important thing. But then we also have to recognize that there are people who benefit from division. In fact, it was one of the most shocking things I found going back to D.C. into the Senate as a chief of staff, coming out of the business. I didn't have a political background. I had a business background. And I remember getting back there, and I was shocked that most of the problems in Washington, D.C. are not problems between the left and the right, the Republicans, the Democrats, the liberals, the conservatives. It's those in power and everyone else. And the thing you have to remember, that we all have to remember, is that dictators, thugs, and bad guys have used division as a way to maintain the status quo of power since the beginning of time. Because if you can convince people that they're too divided to solve healthcare or immigration or whatever the issue may be, then you need a big, strong central government or a central leader to be in charge and in control. And there's a whole industrial complex in Washington, D.C. that benefits and thrives and exists because of division. Much of the national media exists because of division. And it's about clicks and likes and the divisive rhetoric. And so there are people profiting. So when you hear that language, the first thing we all need to do is to step back and say, wait a minute, are we really that divided? And here's an example. One of the things that was just baffling to me was looking at immigration and border security, still a big issue today. And just the angry rhetoric, all of the fundraising emails that go out from the left and the right on build the wall, don't build the wall, open border, you know, whatever it is, and send $25 along with it just to help the cause. I used to call that the shampoo bottle model. Remember what it used to say on the shampoo bottle, Paul? Lather, rinse, repeat. Lather people yeah. up, get them angry, get them frustrated, get them chasing those negative base emotions, then let them rinse those negative emotions off with a nice $25 or $50 contribution, and then you repeat it. So we've actually been conditioned to respond inappropriately to negative base emotions. And it's great for fundraising, it's great for campaigns, it's great for wedge issues. So back to the border. I was shocked at how much agreement there was around immigration and border security. And the problem we have is this divisiveness, again, plays out well on social media, plays out in national media. It's the fake fight followed by the false choice. And what we have to recognize is the compatibility of principles. And when we start with principles, we usually end up getting to good policy. When we start to politics, we get to bad policy and bad results. And so I always begin a conversation about the border or immigration with two important principles, rule of law and compassion. We are a nation of laws and rules, and those have to be upheld. That gives us our sovereignty, that gives us our structure, our certainty and confidence in safety and security. And the United States of America is the most compassionate country on the planet. Americans are regularly the first to show up in a crisis, regularly the first to donate to a cause, regularly the first to help out those that have been impacted negatively, whether it's through war or natural disaster, whatever it may be. So those are compatible. And so as I looked at things happening in the United States Congress, I said, okay, let's go through all of those issues. Everybody agrees. Everybody agrees we need to have a border. Everybody agrees we have to have an entry and exit system. Everyone agrees we need to make it easier to come into the country legally than it is to come in illegally. In fact, over 80% of Americans say legal immigration is good for the country. Illegal immigration is bad for the country. Everybody agrees on that. We need to be able to tell who comes into the country and who leaves the country. I mean, Paul, if Disneyland can tell me where my family is at any moment, at any time in the park over a 3-day period, surely the greatest country on the planet can figure out who's coming in and who's going out. And so it's not a matter of can we get there? It's do we have the willpower and do we have the leadership power to actually get to those conversations? And so a lot of what's broken is broken because of power. And what I always ask the question, what are you afraid of? What are you afraid of? And I ask it to liberals and conservatives alike, Republicans and Democrats. You know, if you're the party of the little guy, then we ought to all be calling for an audit of every program that touches somebody who might be in poverty to make sure there's no waste, fraud, and abuse, and that it's actually producing results that give people that upward climb. If you're really about welfare reform, let's start with some corporate welfare reform. I know you have some thoughts on that as well, in terms of the free market system and not having government picking winners and losers by who has the best lawyers and lobbyists. And so there's so much that we do agree on. We just don't hear it. We don't look for it. And we have to remember that those in power want us to believe that we're too divided. And I actually don't think we're that divided. I think that is the myth of all myths, the lie of all lies. We may be separated, Paul, but it's self-separation. And it's separation based on them, they, those people, all the pejorative-laced things that we hear from the performative politicians, rather than those that are serious lawmakers and those who are actually looking out for what's best for the country.
Yeah, there's so many complexities to figure out what then causes these divisions. You spoke about fear. There's actually a scientific psychological term based upon this called the amygdala hijack, right? Which if I know you're a conservative or a liberal, I pretty much know what you're going to be afraid of. I've been around politics long enough that I could tell you right now what your fears are going to be. And all I have to be willing to do is to go stoke those fears, and it's going to engage your amygdala. And when it engages your amygdala, literally chemically, it knocks out the ability for the neocortex to work. When the neocortex can't work, you can't rationalize, you can't be optimistic, love kind of goes out the door. It's about fight, flight, or freeze. Survival becomes the key importance. And so then the question becomes, okay, well, if that's what's taking place, who's doing it? Oh, gosh, start with the media, all right? You know, you especially the network news companies, right? I think there's a lot of good medias in this country. If you watch the big three at night on the networks, man, they're focused on terrifying you. And whichever side they're on, they're focused on terrifying you. And then politicians gain agency from it. Because once I can terrify you, you lose your agency. You lose your ability to think. And if I can then just convince you I'm the savior for that fear, then you'll give up your ability to make a rational decision. The challenge to that is it can be perfected, right? Especially in a highly partisan system where you have 5,000 seats in America and 70% are determined in the primary, which means that about 8% of the public is actually making the decision. It becomes much easier to manipulate that. But if you come to what I liked about what you were saying is each of us individually, politicians or individuals, if we want to fix this, start with outcomes. What's the value you're trying to get to? What is it that you are really trying to accomplish? And then let's figure out where we have common values, where we have similarities. I agree with you again. There's lots of polling on this. There's huge agreement on all the major issues by most people in the public. Now, that may not be most people who vote within those narrow partisan primaries, but most people in the public, there's a large agreement from. And I do believe, in my experience, Republicans and Democrats alike, most people go into office not because they want to be cynical, mean, and destroy the other person. Some do, but most don't. Most go into it because they want to make a difference.
Yeah.
Your thoughts?
No question about it. Yeah, and I think you've struck such an important note there. In terms of where the country is and the fact that we have so few people participating, the really interesting thing to me is that the country really is a center left to center right nation. the vast majority of the country falls into that space. You have loud and angry voices on the far left and the far right, and they are loud, they are angry, and they are animated, and they are intentional in terms of what they do. And so it's sometimes overwhelming to the rest. And the interesting thing to me is in that group, we often refer to them as the movable middle. And because of they are doing the things that matter, they're raising their families, they're worried about their kids, they're coaching Little League, they're doing all of those things that Americans get up and do every single morning. And because of that, and because of the rancor and everything that they see and hear in the media and on social media, many of them have disengaged from the political process. Now, here's the interesting thing that we found, and this was some polling I did with Scott Rasmussen, is if you look at that movable middle who have disengaged from the process, the only way to get them back engaged is not through any issue. In other words, they're not going to get back into the game because of tax policy or abortion rights or border security or anything else. There are four things that will lead them back into the process. And that is if you are talking about community, compassion, upward mobility, self-reliance. And
self-reliance, upward mobility, community, compassion.
And community. And how many of our elected officials are talking about those issues and talking about things in that way? That's what will bring them back into the process. And so we have to have elected leaders and politicians who are willing to talk different and to go into different places. And rather than just trying to get their own clicks and likes and fundraising email, it's something that my friend, former Senator Ben Sasse from Nebraska would call performative jackassery. And just trying to get that attention and stir things up and stir up the emotions. These people just disconnect because they don't have time and they don't have emotion for it because they're living their version of the American dream. They're trying to create a better space for their children and grandchildren. They're trying to make a difference in their community. And so changing the conversation from the rhetoric and the pejorative laced, you know, name calling back and forth and getting back to community, compassion, upward mobility and self-reliance is such an interesting thing that people want to talk about that. How do we help that? We have an organization here in the state of Utah called the Other Side Academy. And Paul, I'm going to have you come up here and experience this. It's the most fascinating place on the planet, and it is the model. So these are this academy is a group of felons, about 150 of them. They have an average arrest of about 25 times each. Most of them have spent years in the system behind bars. They live together at the Other Side Academy. They are referred to as students, and it is a therapeutic community. So they live together, 100% accountability for each other. No guns, no guards, no therapists, just 100% accountability to each other to learn the skills, develop the disciplines that they didn't get where they were either in a gang, on the street, or in and out of the criminal justice system. That usually just creates better criminals in the process. Now, here's the kicker. You'll love this. They don't take any money from the federal government, from the state government, or the local government.
Okay, how do they do this?
They fund themselves. They have social enterprises. Their lead social enterprise is a moving company. Now, I want you to think about this. These are people who used to steal your TV out your window and go sell it for drug money. They are now providing the greatest care to make your move. They are the number one rated customer service moving company in the state of Utah.
I think
every executive in the country should go watch them move. You'll never hear more sophisticated conversations, more dignified working through problems and challenges and setbacks. And so they have developed this model that instead of costing taxpayers and citizens money to have them housed and locked up behind bars, they're giving back. It is an amazing thing, but it's based on principles. and they live these principles. They hold each other accountable. I remember they started having this great success. And then, of course, government wanted to come in and regulate them because they weren't a 90-day treatment program. They weren't a, you know, lockup facility. What will happen to the neighborhood? Well, the neighborhood has gone through the moon. It is the cleanest, safest place in downtown Salt Lake City. Why? Because these people take pride in it. And it is just the most extraordinary thing you've ever seen. Now they've got they've set up another one in Denver. They're looking at other sites across the country. But I share that with you, Paul, just as an example of enterprise, innovation, and that government doesn't have to be the solution to everything. And when we base it on those core things of self-reliance, compassion, community, then we get that upward mobility. It's one of the other things that we have going here in the state of Utah. Utah's the most upwardly mobile place on the planet. In other words, someone born into poverty or someone who falls into poverty here has a better chance of not just getting out of poverty, but getting into the middle class and beyond than anywhere else. Why? Because of that connective tissue, civil society, communities coming together and with those same principles in mind. And so we need to model that and stop looking to Washington to solve the big problems. Washington's conditioned us to believe that. If there's a big problem, Washington has to solve it, or the president has to do it with the stroke of a pen. That's not the way it's supposed to work. And the Other Side Academy is just a beautiful expression of that and just a model. I mean, these people are some of the most, this is the most highly functioning, highest integrity places you will ever walk into. You will question everything about yourself before you're done. And it is amazing.
Yeah, I would definitely love to do that. You know, this whole idea of self-agency is so important in a democracy. It's so important in Western democracy because the idea is that there's no way for government to fix every problem we have. We have to be engaged ourselves. But in really having self-agency, it starts with accountability. You have to be accountable for yourself. And you have to recognize that you too have some good in you and some evil in you. I mean, it's easy to point to the other guy, whether he be a prisoner or a Republican or a Democrat or, you know, a Trump supporter or a member of the elite. It's easy to point to them and say, they're the problem. But the reality is each of us have good and evil inside of us. And if we become accountable for that, one of the first things we do is we quit labeling other people and we listen to them as an individual. The second thing that's important, which I think it sounds like you're really doing well with this program, is you have to have a sense of purpose. What is your purpose? What's your meaning in life? Now, Viktor Frankl, who spent time in a prisoner of war camp or in a concentration camp, Auschwitz, wrote this great book where he talked about it, but he said, there are really three or four areas that you get purpose from. Doing what you love, that becomes an important aspect. The second part of it that is where you can gain meaning or purpose is what you create, who you serve or what you serve. And finally, you can actually gain a sense of purpose from struggling. The fact that you are challenged actually helps you find a sense of meaning and purpose because you recognize that you have to keep trying to overcome that. But that's what they're doing. They're struggling because of maybe past decisions that they've made, maybe mistakes that they've made, but they've created a sense of purpose for themselves to be able to pull out of it. And they're doing it by creating something new, which is why I love free enterprise. It's not just the great products that we create. It's the idea that we have ownership. We're not working for a state-run factory. We're not working for somebody else's ideal society that needs to be created. We're doing it because it's ours, because we have ownership, because it's something that we can create and innovate and not only be responsible for the problems that come with it, but also being able to enjoy in the victories and the successes that come with it as well.
Yeah, no question about that. And that purpose, man's search for meaning, I think is another one of those core principles that we need to get back to. I often say that what we choose to ignore or forget, our children will never know. And what our children don't know, our grandchildren will never possess. And some of these very core principles around meaning and purpose, you know, with the recent eclipse It was a nice moment to have tens of millions of people looking heavenward for a moment and just kind of recalibrating kind of that cosmic perspective. In fact, Paul, a couple of years ago, I had a good friend of mine race into my office, and he said, "Oh, you've got to pick up this this book from Neil deGrasse Tyson. It's called Astrophysics for People in a Hurry." And I thought, okay, people in a hurry, that part I get. I'm not sure why I need astrophysics, but I picked it up anyway. And the very last chapter of the book, Neil deGrasse Tyson lays out what he calls the cosmic perspective. And the cosmic perspective is humility. Humility. And my good friend, Dr. David Bob from the Bill of Rights.
The idea is that is you look to the stars and all of a sudden you recognize your small place within it. Is that the idea?
Yeah, yeah. And so that humility, understanding your place in the world, changes everything. I mean, why in the world would you get all upset about what somebody said on social media with that kind of perspective?
Right.
Dr. David Bob talked about it as the vital virtue of the nation. He wrote a brilliant book everybody should check out about humility as this vital virtue. He goes through Washington and a lot of the founders. And while they were very driven, very ambitious people, they had this sense of humility that was most powerful. Because when you come from a place of humility, then you can start to ask better questions. Then you actually listen better, especially to people that you disagree with, people who live different, think different, act different than you do. Because if you can't even think, well, I wonder why Paul thinks that's the best solution to that, or I wonder why she thinks this is a good way to deal with this issue, we've lost it all. One of my fears for our constitutional republic is the loss of curiosity. If we lose our ability to question because we're too busy demonizing someone we might disagree with, then we're in real trouble. As I said, the real miracle of Philadelphia was the fact that these people with very strong ideas, very different ideas than what we came out with, were willing to have radical curiosity about possibilities. And because of that, and because they treated each other with dignity and respect, that they asked questions, they listened, sometimes they listened for a long time, they were able to get to a better place. And it's one of the things that our good friend and former Senator Joe Lieberman, who passed away not too long ago, what he called the integrity of compromise. Sadly, our politicians and media have turned compromise either into a dirty word or a squishy, awful sellout kind of word, but the integrity of compromise, that you don't have to give up your principles, but you can get to a better solution. It's one thing to, you know, get 70 or 80% of maybe what you hoped for. It's another to get zero and wave a flag while you're going off the cliff. It just doesn't add up in the end. But that also requires humility, requires curiosity, requires that ability to ask better questions, and more importantly, listen to another person's response.
Now, did you know Joe well?
You know, he and I have been connected for a number of years. He came on my program very regularly. I spent time in his office back in New York. And that was a guy who understood the integrity of compromise, and he just understood integrity in and of itself. Mm-hmm. One of the things that he described to me that was so stirring and telling goes back to Bill Clinton and the Monica Lewinsky scandal. And you may recall, Paul, that that really came about because Joe Lieberman, then a Democrat, went to the floor of the United States Senate and spoke out. No one had said anything. There was all the swirling going on about the controversy, but it was Joe Lieberman who spent a weekend at home pacing around saying, well, I helped on his campaign. He's a friend. And he was able to get to the point of, wait a minute, this is about a principle. And I have to speak about principle. I have to stand on that principle. And he did. That was an incredibly excruciating thing for him to do, but he did it. And, you know, then, you know, just a few years later, he's on the ticket with Al Gore as the vice presidential candidate. He also described the end of that election in 2000. Of course, we all remember hanging chads and ballots mm-hmm. in Florida. And an amazing thing, he described it. He said, as the Supreme Court decision came down, it came down late. They honestly felt they had so many different paths to get to a result. They believed they won Florida. And they believed there were many more legal paths and procedural paths to actually make that happen. But he said, Al Gore called him after the Supreme Court ruling had come down, and he said, we have to concede. Inauguration Day is not that far away, and the country needs to move on. And so think about that. Again, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, however you feel about all of that, behind the scenes, there was someone who still really believed they had a chance and believed that they actually had won, and asked the harder question of what's in the best interest of the country, not what's in the best interest of me or my political future or my grip on power. And so it's statesmen and stateswomen like that that I think we're lacking today. And sadly, it's because we're rewarding all the wrong behaviors. We're not rewarding those that stand on principle. We're not rewarding those that are willing to take a hard vote, even though it may cost them an election. Anytime I am interviewing someone running for office, and I have asked this question of people running for president of the United States down to the local city council. And the question I think is the most important question that we all should be thinking about before we cast a vote for anybody. And the question is, campaigns are hard. This is all really difficult. What will make all of this worth it, even if you lose? Or what would make it worth it in your first term to get done, even if it meant you couldn't have a second? Or how would this person make a difference in the world if they weren't in elected office? Because if everything's contingent on them being in that position or getting a higher position, they will never be in position to show political courage and real integrity, because everything will be consultant certified and poll tested or approved. And it's a very different set of calculations. And so asking people that question, what would make it worth it even if you lost? What would make it worth it to get done even if it meant you had to stop serving once you got that done? Or how will this person make a difference outside of office? Those are things we should be asking ourselves about before we ever cast a ballot.
Joe Lieberman was definitely one of the most honorable people that I've worked with. What I found to be interesting, or what I find to be interesting, and Joe talked about this when he was on my show, if you watch the news networks today, they're going to not focus on the people like Joe Lieberman. They're going to focus on people like AOC and Green. And so everybody begins to believe that the Democratic Party is represented by AOC, and the Republican Party is represented by Green. And the answer is, that doesn't even look close to who the people are that represent those two parties. There are good people on both sides with great ideas that are working hard, but they get no attention because they're not bombastic. And when you have 435 people and you focus on two, the answer is you're not really giving us a real picture of what exists.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's easy to focus on those extreme or loud or angry voices because they do. And we need to remember that's what they want you to believe, because it gives them power and it gives them prominence. It gives them position. If we all believe that it's about Marjorie Taylor Greene or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, if we believe that, then they have more power. If we choose not to believe that, or we reject that premise and go talk to the rest of the members of Congress and find out, oh, wow, there's actually a big group right here between the left and the right that are actually trying to get some things done. Those are the things that we have to turn our attention to. But it is a model of distraction and distortion that often prevents us from getting to those more important conversations.
You know, it's what I like about podcasts. You're getting a chance to be able to really talk about ideas at a deeper level. And people are getting a chance to know you differently. If we were only covering 30 seconds, we'd pick out some 30 seconds in here where you talked about some divisive issue, because that's going to be the one that's going to get the most attention. And unfortunately, that's going to give people not only a skewed perspective of you, but of the system itself. Now, you also talked about an important concept. I want to talk about this for a moment because I think it's important in all of our lives, not just our politicians. I love this story written by Homer where you have Ulysses, who is in this gigantic battle with Cyclops. He's trying to get through this passage. And as he goes through it, he decides to sneak up on him and take his spear and poke him in the eye. Now, he is successful. He gets through, but he can't help himself. He stands up at the end and he says, "I am Ulysses." Well, of course, his cousin Poseidon's watching the whole thing and goes to Zeus and asks if he can destroy his life. He says, "Well, he can't destroy his life, but you can destroy him for the next 10 years or 20 years. So, and that's how he differentiated between fate and destiny. Your fate, you actually have some say in. When he stood up and said, "I am Ulysses," he was basically tempting the gods. But at the same time, we still have some destiny that we're heading towards that maybe we don't have control over. We determine what's going to happen to us. We have the ability to, if we decide that we're going to go out and become part of this noise where we're contributing to attacking Trump or attacking Biden, as opposed to trying to listen to them and trying to and recognizing, you know, power in the United States doesn't come down to even one person. It's distributed among senators and congressmen and city councils and state governments and school boards. There's no one person really in charge by design. But we become hubris when we begin to think that the only ideas that matter are the ones that I care about.
Yeah, no question about it. You know, one of my favorite things when I lived in Washington, and I actually never moved my family there. I commuted, so I would fly out on a Sunday evening, spend the week there till Thursday night, fly back. And so I just had this little flat over a guy's garage, kind of tucked in back behind the Supreme Court. And so when the day was finally done, which, as you know, back there, Paul, is usually about midnight or 1 a.m., I would actually walk from the Senate office through the United States Capitol, walking towards this little one-room place that I had. And so I always walked through. In those days, you could do it without security. I could walk right through the Capitol, right through the Capitol Rotunda. And there's nothing more powerful than walking through the Capitol Rotunda at about midnight or 1 a.m. when everything is quiet and still. And often I would just stop there and look around, and I'd usually stop and actually go sit on the bench and look up at the what I think is one of the most important paintings in our history. And it's the painting of George Washington resigning his commission, returning that to the Continental Congress. And here it was, had to be the first time in history that the commander of the conquering forces did not assume absolute power, gave it back to the people, to the representatives. And Washington understood the fallacy of the irreplaceable. And this is one of the great myths that many of our elected officials tell us, that they're irreplaceable. And they'll often do it in kind of a patronizing sort of way. They'll say, Your vote is yours. That is your sacred right. That is your most sacred right, your ability to cast a vote. You can vote for anyone you want. But if you don't vote for me, you're going to lose power. You're going to lose prestige. You're going to lose position. You're going to lose all the perks and benefits that go along with that. And that's the great myth, this fallacy of the indispensable, fallacy of the irreplaceable. And so I used to love to just sit there and just recognize what Washington understood. Everyone's, even Washington, as indispensable man as he was replaceable. And he recognized that the future and fate of the nation had to be dependent on we the people. And sometimes we do point to media, sometimes we do point to the politicians as the problem, but sometimes we have to look in the mirror too and recognize, am I buying into that? Am I casting my vote for this person because I know it'll be beneficial to my business or to my community, maybe at the expense of others? Are we keeping people there just because they've been there forever and so that's prestigious to us? We have to ask the harder questions. But recognizing the fallacy of the irreplaceable I think is an important place for us to start our thinking. And then, as you said, it's not just the 435 or 535 or 537, if you count the president and the vice president, or you could add a few more in there. It's the 519,000 school board members, county council people, mayors, and on through the system. But ultimately, it's we the people. And if we really want the change, if we really want the transformation we're hoping for the future of the country, that's a you and me problem. That's a you and me issue. That's where it has to begin. That's the only place it'll end.
Yeah, it's a real paradox, because I know enough from reading history that definitely one or two people could make a huge difference in a society. I also know that our founders created a systems of checks and balances at a lot of different levels. I can remember people saying, we won't survive Obama. We won't survive Trump. We won't survive Biden. And now they're saying, well, we won't survive Trump again. This isn't the advertisement for Trump, because he's definitely not my guy, but we'll survive him. It's a mistake to believe we won't survive Biden or Trump, because we're bigger than that. We just are. However, it does demand what you're saying, which is leadership is diffused, and each of us are leaders. We need to be leaders. We need to lead with our families, with our friends. And leadership doesn't mean doing what they're doing, being divisive and fighting and trying to figure out a way to terrify other people. It means listening to other people and trying to find common ground and trying to help move things forward so that things get just a little bit better than when you found them.
Yeah, no question about it. And it is that look in the mirror. I've been part of a great group with Tim Shriver, who, of course, is the chairman of the Special Olympics. We started a couple of years ago this idea around the dignity index and actually scoring how we talk to each other. And initially, it began with a focus on the political process. And are we speaking with contempt and anger and fear and frustration, or are we talking about our differences with dignity and treating others with respect? And it was really interesting, Paul. They developed this scoring system, again, kind of that contempt being the worst and dignity being the highest, and ways to score speech, not based on whether or not I agree with your policy issue or your position on something, but on how you talk about it. And they actually trained a group of students at the University of Utah to take political speech or debate and then use this model. And it was so fascinating to watch how they would do this and how they learned it didn't matter if someone was a Republican or a Democrat, just score the speech. And so that was an interesting thing to look at. As you know, we score our politicians on everything. Their position and the votes they've taken on taxes, the way they vote on immigration, the way they vote on healthcare, but we never score them on how they talk and how they communicate with others. And so they started doing this, and so that's a great exercise in and of itself. Mm-hmm. The Dignity Index is a great tool. But the interesting thing was the students said, yeah, this politics stuff is all interesting. And they had students from across the political spectrum. So there was no agenda there, and they were all scoring. And so as they started to talk about it, they said, well, the thing that's really helping me is it actually changed the way I've been talking with my mom or dad, or the way I interact with my boyfriend or girlfriend. Or one of them said, I went and took down one of my own social media posts because I realized I was down at the contempt level, not dignified at all or respectful at all. And so it became this mirror where they could say, how am I speaking to someone I disagree with, including my spouse or my best friend or my boss at work or colleague? And when you start getting into that space, then it all really begins to change.
Yeah. You know, my view, and again, I'm deeply interested in your thought on this. I've run lots of different companies. Companies need a common narrative. They need a centralizing gravitational force that pulls it together. Countries need the same thing. Now, sometimes I think we're in search of it, not recognizing it's been here all along, right? I mean, it goes all the way back to that day when we said, hey, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. We have not lived up to that perfectly. That is absolutely true. But it was the ideal that we were striving towards all along. And it you know, you could ask the question, well, yes, slavery was an abomination. Yes, slavery was evil. But why? I mean, it's been on the planet forever. Why was it evil? Oh, because we said all men are created equal. Because we said, if God gives you dignity, then government has to give you dignity. It was the common narrative. What I'm worried about in society, and this is not even close to the majority, it's just the biggest group getting coverage, is that there are these two factions on each side who no longer follow that edict of let's judge people by the content of their character. Let's judge people by the content of their character, not by the color of their skin. They now are seeing us based upon the group that we're in. And that is a, you know, you could, a lot of people hear that and they'll think woke society. Well, I can show you young men marching in 2017 in Charlottesville that were saying Jews will not replace us. This is an excess of both sides. But when trying to find the common narrative that pulls us together, it seems to me that the common narrative is just exactly what you're saying. Start with a little humility, look inwardly, and give the other person the same respect that you would want. And if we start with that, we don't see them as a member of a group or a race or an economic class or being part of the gilded society, whatever. We just see them as a human being. It changes everything.
Yeah, just see them, I think is the important thing. Oneness is not sameness, especially in America. And I think we've been having all the wrong conversations and all the wrong debates. Yes, we want a history that is warts and all, but not just warts. There's never been a society that has lifted more people out of poverty, fueled more freedom, driven more dreams than the United States of America. And so we can recognize those moments where we haven't lived up to the principles we profess to believe. And those are instructive moments if we let them be instructive. And then if we're willing to have the humility to take the lesson and then say, okay, now where do we go? And also to give people the grace. It's really easy, Paul, to poke holes in history. There was one historian who said, you know, be careful when you travel to the past. It's like going to a foreign country. They do things differently. And it's very easy to judge from our very enlightened space in history to look back and say, oh, how could they be so decrepit and awful and terrible? Surely the whole thing is a mess. And so you have to be careful. You have to, when you travel, you know, don't be the loud, obnoxious American. Go back and learn from history. And then as we learn from history, then we can have a completely different conversation about history. And we can recognize that. I remember going back through recently, between 1976 and 1979, Ronald Reagan out of office as governor. So between the time he ran for the presidency after being governor and the time he ran and won in 1980, he did a daily radio program. He wrote 500 to 600 words every day. No staff, no research team. Most of them are written by hand on little 3x5 cards. And they're amazing. In fact, most of them you could play today and they're spot on. North Korea, Russia, the economy, and a wide range of things. But in one of those, Reagan shared a challenge he had been given in 1976 to write a letter to the future. So he had been asked as part of Los Angeles to write a letter to the future that was going to be put in a time capsule and opened up in 2076, bicentennial of Los Angeles, tricentennial of the country. And Reagan took this assignment and thought, oh, this is going to be piece of cake. I talk about the future all the time. And he was riding down the highway there in the back of a car, thought, I'm just going to knock this thing out. And he started to write. And he said it became the most complicated and difficult thing he'd ever written. He said because he recognized that the people who would read that letter 100 years later would know how we did. at the time, he was writing about Russia and nuclear missiles being pointed at each other, talking about climate and energy crisis and all of those things. And he said, the future will look back, and how will they look back? Will they look back with appreciation for the sacrifices we made, the hard things we did? Or will they look back with a little bit of a grievance that we squandered the opportunity and left them? Because they'll be living in the world that we left them based on our decisions. And so it's having that kind of perspective, both for history looking back, but also we all ought to be thinking about, what am I leaving as I write the future and live that every day?
So here's my last question to you. A lot of people will see people like you and I, and they think, oh gosh, you were born into privilege, right? You were born into privilege. It was given to you. I'm interested in one of the big adversities of your life and how you were able to overcome it. And I ask that question because I do think that if we look at people that way, meaning I don't care if it's Elon Musk or who it is, if we only look at them and we make this assumption that they have had no challenges, we lose the lessons that they have to give. So yeah. I'd love to know what was one of your big adversities and how you overcame it.
I actually have a plaque on my desk that says, by making the same mistakes over and over again, at least I learned to do one thing well. So I've had adversities and challenges from health challenges to business failures and everything in between. But I learned a lesson really early that has kind of marked how I approach all of those setbacks and challenges. Growing up, I played basketball and I had a singular goal. I wanted to play basketball at the university. I'm not super tall. And so I kind of mapped it out. What's it going to take for a guy who's 5'9" to make it into a college basketball team? And for me, that meant 6 hours a day, 6 days a week from the time I was a seventh grader in junior high through my senior year of high school. And that was it. And I did it. I mean, it was minimum 6 hours a day. A lot of days it was more than that. And as I got to my senior year in high school, things were lining up just the way I'd planned. Things were going great. And then as my senior year started to wind down, so did my right shoulder. And it got to the point where it would pretty much dislocate wherever it wanted to. I don't know if you've ever had the experience, Paul, of waking up in the morning on one side of the bed and your shoulder's way over on the other. It's not a good thing. I went to the doctor who just shook his head, said, we're going to have to do some pretty major reconstructive work in there. And then he delivered the news that your chances of coming back and playing competitive basketball are a little less than zero. And so I did what we all tend to do. I immediately went into denial. That, no, this is not happening to me. I've worked too hard. So I kept playing, tried to play my way through it and around it. And of course, it just kept getting worse until I finally had to get it done. And I remember 2 days before the surgery, I was sitting down in my bedroom feeling very sorry for myself. This was so not fair. And this, you know, unbelievable unfairness and just feeling sorry. And the phone rang. And it was a gentleman who lived in our neighborhood, very well known, very well respected, very successful. And he invited me to come over to his house. I had no idea what he wanted to talk to me about, but I agreed, cleaned up, drove over to his place. He met me at the front door. No handshake, no thanks for coming over. He just turned around. He walked me back into his little office, his den. And we sat down and he told me this story. This is the piece. He said, there once was an old man who lived in this tiny little village, and the only possession he had, his only form of wealth, his only way to provide for himself was his horse. And one night in that little village, there was a big storm, thunder, lightning. The horse got spooked, and as it raced about the corral, it broke through the gate and ran off into the desert. So the next morning, the people of the village are coming around, assessing the damage from the storm. They see the empty corral, the broken gate. And the people of the village say to the old man, oh, this is so awful. This is so terrible. You've lost your horse, your only form of wealth, your only possession. What an awful, what a terrible thing. And the old man looked at the people and he said, no, you don't know this is so bad. You don't know this is an awful or a terrible thing. Well, the days went by and one night the horse returned and brought with it 50 wild horses that it had been running with out in the desert. So now the people of the village come back, and now they're all saying, wow, this is so amazing. This is so wonderful. Now you have all of these horses, all of this wealth. You'll never have a worry. What a great, what a wonderful thing. And the old man looked at the people and he said, no, you don't know this is so great. You don't know this is a wonderful thing. Well, the old man had a son who was one of the great young warriors in the village, spent a lot of time perfecting his skill with the sword and the sling. And one day he was out breaking in one of those new horses and he was thrown and his leg was crushed. Never again would he be able to use those skills he had worked so hard to develop. Again, the people of the village came by. What a tragedy. How awful. This great young warrior is now crippled. What an awful, what a terrible thing. But the old man looks at the people and says, no, you don't know this is so bad. You don't know this is an awful or a terrible thing. Well, not many days later, the cry of war was heard throughout the land. The warlords came through the village, gathered all those that were able to fight, and led them off to a terrible battle. And that was the end of the story. He said, I want you to remember that. He stood up. He walked me out of the house. I got in my car. I started driving home. I was partially waiting for Paul Harvey to come on with the rest of the story. But that was the story. And after I had my surgery, as I lay in that hospital room, and as my friends and family and coaches came to visit, they all started the same. Boy, this is so awful. You spent all these years, all this time, and it's over. What an awful, terrible thing. And without even thinking, I was responding, no, you don't know this is so bad. You don't know this is an awful or a terrible thing. And Paul, I'm telling you, it wasn't. It was the best thing that ever happened to me. During the time of recovery, a lot of solitary time, going through that rehabilitation process on my shoulder, I was learning things, understanding things that were way more important than making baskets or winning championships. And the reason I share that, Paul, is regardless of the setbacks or challenges that we face, individually, as a community, or as a nation, we don't know it's so bad. We just know it's hard. We know it's difficult. Sometimes it's hard to get out of bed in the morning. Sometimes you just as soon pull the covers over your head and just hunker down. But there's an opportunity in there. As long as we're willing to stand up, step forward, and keep moving. That's the power of the nation. That's the power of the human spirit. That is what makes us both human and divine. And it's also what connects us, that interconnectedness that we have as individuals and families and communities is the strength of the nation. And as long as we remember that, we can do all kinds of hard things in this country. The politics is not going to be our greatest obstacle in the end. It's how we treat each other and what we're willing to do collectively for each other and with each other that will actually create that better, brighter future for all of us.
That's so beautiful. I'm not going to add anything to it but to say thank you, Boyd, for being on the Optimistic American Show today.
Great to be with you, Paul. Thank you.
Thanks for joining the Optimistic American Show. Help us grow by subscribing to our channel. If you enjoyed the episode, please leave a like and a comment. There is so much more that we have planned. We can't wait for you to embark upon this journey with us.